For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome.
Good evening.
I'm very happy to have back with us again to speak Paul Kopp, who's the professor of East Asian Studies at the University of Chicago. And he's doing really important, interesting work. When I first started studying Buddhism and practicing, the Tang Dynasty in the 700s and 800s was kind of the golden age. And then later on, scholars said, well, actually, you know, all this stuff that we think was written in the Tang was written in the Song. But actually, there's this wonderful treasure trove of materials found in the early 20th century in the Dunhuang Caves on the Silk Road that really illuminates what was going on in China early on and during the Tang period. And Paul is one of the relatively few scholars actually working on the Dunhuang material and translating and commenting on it for us. So it's really important work that he's doing, and he's here tonight to talk about something related to the Heart Sutra. So thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you. Wonderful to be in this room, as always. I won't be talking about Dunhuang stuff, you know. But we can talk about it afterward if you like. Boy, sitting Zazen together and chanting the Heart Sutra, it was really one of the good things in life. And it's enough, isn't it? But here I have to talk about the Dharma. It's a problem. Yeah. In Chinese they have this saying, right, painting legs on a snake. You know? No, it's a nice snake, but could use some legs. Right? Here I go. I'll be talking about a small part of this text, which you can find, it's been translated into English as a comprehensive commentary on the Heart Sutra, published in this series put up by the Numata Center, the Bukkyo Dendo Kyokai, and there are many different texts. I hope at least some of you know about them. This is a commentary on the text we just chanted, much longer than the Heart Sutra itself, of course, in the way of these things. A multi-legged snake in this book by a very important figure in East Asian Buddhism and beyond, named Kui Ji, who is a student of the very famous Xuanzang, right? Most famous as a traveler whose journey was famous in many different versions, including in a very much sort of fantasticized, is that the word? Fantasy version called Journey to the West, where you have the figure of the Monkey King, among others. But also we'll not be talking about that. Well, that's a wonderful story. It's a commentary on the entirety of the Heart Sutra, right? Even though the Heart Sutra is quite short. But the Heart Sutra itself is considered to be a sort of all the Buddhist teachings in a nutshell, right? Heart in the Heart Sutra doesn't mean the heart, it means the heart of something, the heart of the matter, the core of it. So any commentary on the full Heart Sutra, you know, at least has the opportunity to sort of cover everything, right, or try to. And there are many commentaries on the Heart Sutra from all different periods in Buddhist history. Some of them are very long, even much longer than this one. Tonight, I'm only going to talk about a very short part of the commentary, focusing on the that I gave you in the handout. I hope there were enough. I hadn't read this before. I actually decided I was looking for a text to read in a class I'm teaching this fall, and I sort of didn't want to use some of the ones I'd used before. And I had this book on my shelf, and I just started looking at it, and I thought, wow, this really this is great. It really covers a lot of good stuff. This will work well. So I just, really without reading it, I asked the bookstore on campus to order it. And then I thought, well, I guess I should read it before the quarter starts. So I did. That's great. I was very happy this one worked out. Sometimes it doesn't always work out when you do that. And one thing I was especially happy to find was that, unlike many commentaries from the Tang Dynasty, this Kuaiji, a figure of the middle, roughly middle of the 7th century, they can go into just mind-numbing or mind-opening or both detail about Buddhist philosophy, the nature of the mind, the nature of everything, right? And this one does that to a certain extent. But what I was very happy to find is that it really keeps practice in mind. And it keeps coming back to practice, right? What does it mean by practice? Well, that's what I'll try to talk a little bit about. And the section that I'll be focusing on is commentaries on the early lines in the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara. And here I'm just going to read the translation that they use in the book. Here, Avalokiteshvara, which is of course very close to the one we just chanted. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing the profound Prajnaparamita, had an illuminating vision, that's an interesting way of putting it, of the emptiness of the five skandhas, right? That is the things that are said, the heaps, skandha literally means something like heaps, that make up what we take to be ourselves and the world, right? So it's just commentaries on that line, not even the whole sentence. The part about, and then, you know, saved all beings from suffering, or however that goes, I'm forgetting. That's in the later section, right? It has a whole different section devoted to that. So the first part is, in fact, just on this, what does it mean when the Heart Sutra says to practice the profound Prajnaparamita, or to, as the version we just chanted has it, to deeply practice the Prajnaparamita. It gives, as I say, I think a very simple version of this, right? And it says it a few different times in the commentary that, wow, it doesn't say wow, but you know, let me throw it away. It says, wow, there are a lot of Buddhist teachings out there, right? Buddhist teachings are limitless, in fact, it says. And interestingly, this is said to be one of, well, let me come back to that later. I'll come back to it soon. But they really boil down to just a very simple program, and in fact to three different steps, right? And the first one thing, and then three different steps. The first is what I think many of you will have encountered from readings or from, you know, your own practice or elsewhere, is this idea that one must give rise to what is called the bodhicitta, right? The mind or the vow, the desire to awakening, the promise to oneself and to Buddhas perhaps, or to all beings that one will awaken, right? Bodhi, awakening, and citta, mind, right? It talks about this as many other texts do, of course. It's not, there's not a lot in here that's so different from anything else. No surprises, in the talk here. But why would one want to do that, right? And it gives a few different reasons. And really two of them stood out for me. And I should say this talk is really a kind of an idiosyncratic personal talk. I'm not going to try to present a full version of Kuaiji's teachings, to say nothing of the full version of the teachings in this text, in this commentary, but just some things that really stood out for me. One of them was fatigue. I'm just getting tired, you know, tired of it all. Fatigue at the world. And I love this next line, and awe at our own ignorance. These are two things I'm familiar with, particularly the latter of the two. And so feeling tired of sort of the way things have been, and just feeling awe and sort of and despair, I think, at one's own ignorance, one says what? Well, you know, this has got to change. And so in the sort of standard Buddhist picture, right, the standard versions of the standard Buddhist stories, one vows to change them, right? But then quite immediately, he says, well, you know, if fatigue at something drives one to practice, right? Fatigue at the teachings, at this vast welter of the teachings, right? I mean, you go into, you know, they have just bookstores themselves full of Buddhist books, right? That he says this itself can induce a kind of fatigue, right? I mean, reading all these books, right? Hearing all these talks. I mean, my goodness, there are so many Dharma talks available on the internet now. It's, you can, you know, there are just a lot of them. He says that this also can lead to a kind of fatigue, right? And a kind of difficulty, a sense of difficulty at the hardness, the difficulty of practice, right? That this can drive one away. So if interest, I thought this was very interesting. So if fatigue is something that can drive, a certain kind of fatigue drives one to practice, another kind of fatigue can sort of drive one away from practice, right? Again, something I'm very familiar with, right? Fatigue and what? The vast welter of the teachings. Also, the vastness or even the sense of impossibility of awakening the way it's described, particularly in a lot of early Mahayana texts where, you know, to become a Buddha will take countless, incalculable ages of the world. But that's a long time, right? I mean, that's going to take a zillion lifetimes, really, just for one step in these early texts. I mean, boy, that just seems kind of hard. That seems too much, right? And I think Kweji is he's acutely aware of this, the possibility that one will feel this way when encountering the teachings, right? So he keeps stressing the need for encouragement, right? For taking courage, taking heart, and for encouraging, for being encouraged in one's practice, right? So that one isn't driven away from it, right, by the kind of fatigue or dismay. And he says, not only him, but he gives, there, you know, if you read these Chinese commentaries on sutras, they're nothing if not incredibly schematic, right? You know, they take a text that just seems quite simple and they will really just expand it and blow it up and turn it into, you know, the first word can be understood these 15 different ways, and each way, well, there are 27 different ways, you know, of understanding the first way of understanding the first word. Boy, and I'm a little bit exaggerating, but I'm not really exaggerating all that much. If you've read these things, they talk about fatigue, you know, they can just sort of, and difficulty. So he says, he has a much simpler way of understanding the Heart Sutra, one of the ones that he likes, and that is the first section, again, this, you know, Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, practiced Prajnaparamita, saw something, and then good things happened, right? This line, he says, this is entirely about encouragement, right? Mm-hmm. To say, wow, I guess, and he doesn't say exactly how we should take it as encouragement, but I guess he means something like, this guy did it, right? That doesn't sound so hard. I mean, that sounds relatively easy. It's just about seeing something, seeing things correctly, right? And then good things happen from that. And that, in fact, is kind of the way what he asserts to be at the core of Buddhist teachings. Like, we have this vast welter of Dharma talks and books and different schools, etc., in different countries. You know, ex-Buddhism, Y-Buddhism, Z-Buddhism, right? But he says, you know, really at the core of it, the practice is extremely simple. And he, Kweji, the author, was a monk in what's called the Yogacara tradition, right, or the mind-only, what does that mean? Sounds hard. We'll talk about that in a minute, right? The mind-only tradition. So for him, of course, that the basics of that school are going to be the basics of how you do it. So if we can look at the handout, I number the pages, there are only two. But one of them says, Kweji on Practice, a free translation on the top. And this is not the translation you get in the book here. This one, their translation is perfectly good, but it's sort of in, you know, Buddhistese, right? English Buddhistese, and it can be a little bit. So I thought, no, I'm just going to try to give it a translation, which I think is very accurate. I hope is accurate. I think is accurate, but it's much, but it's a little bit more, I don't know, user friendly. So I'm just going to read it here. If you know Chinese, you can just tell me how wrong I am about these translations. But you know, afterward. So for a long time, we've been unable to understand the difference between what's real and what isn't. We've had all kinds of mental and emotional difficulties because of this and have suffered terribly. Now, there are three steps involved in changing this situation. First, in our practice, we must see things clearly. This is usually translated, we must have correct contemplation. Sounds better. Basically, we should see things clearly, right? Second, understanding what is good and what is bad, or the word is actually often translated as evil, what is good and what is evil. Our translators here translate it as what is right and what is wrong. Okay. In our practice, we must cultivate the former and cut off the latter. This actually was the origin of, you know, the great song, "You've got to act." That may not be true. But it could be true. It's sort of Tin Pan Alley Dharma here. Sorry. Third, I'm a terrible lecturer. This is my, so we have first, we see things clearly. Second, you know, cultivate the good, get rid of the bad, don't mess with Mr. In-Between, something like that. Third, when we have perfected this practice, seeing things clearly, practicing the good, not practicing the bad, fruits of virtue will be attained. Good things will happen. Right. That's it. That's Buddhist practice. Though the teachings of the Buddhas are uncountable, in terms of practice, they do not go beyond these three. Thus, those who practice should study according to them. Now here's the Yogacara bit, comes next. So what does it mean to see things clearly, anyway? What does it mean? What is it that we must see clearly in practice? First, looking carefully at all that arises due to conditions, that is, form, mind, and mental factors, we see that, in terms of their nature, they are simply like illusory sky flowers, or flowers in the sky, however they translate that, confusing the ignorant. What are sky flowers? Sky flowers is this image you see throughout certain kinds of Buddhist literature. It refers to, sometimes it's said to refer to, you know, you have some kind of problem with your eye, you know, your eyes aren't, there's the cataract or whatever, and so you look up and you see, you know, there's all this stuff up there that's actually not there, right? Those are sky flowers. So that is a metaphor for how we should see, you know, everything, according to this. All things, at least not everything, but all things, how's it go here? That arise due to conditions, causes and conditions, right? Which, if you know Buddhism, means basically everything, right? Everything arises due to causes and conditions. There was a tree, it grew due to all kinds of causes and conditions. It was chosen for whatever causes and conditions. It was chopped down, da-da-da-da-da. It was carried someplace, it was made into this, da-da-da-da. Now it's here, right? Just a whole endless, sort of unknowably vast web of causes and conditions leads not only to it being this thing here, but to it being right here before me, right? Etc. These are what are called the three natures, right? According to Yogacara or mind-only Buddhism. The first one is called Paratantra, right? Or the other dependence of things, right? Things arise due to conditions. But they are like sky flowers, right? They are not real, at least in the way we see them. Which, you know, understand, seems to mean that there's actually something there, but it's just not, we see it wrong, right? The way we see it is not correct. We'll come back to this a little later. Things seen in this way, are called, quote, things that arise based on other teachings. This is the first nature, or the first non-nature sometimes, in Yogacara Buddhism. Ignorant beings, that is me, misunderstanding the nature of things, take what doesn't really exist in the way they think it does, since it all has only the substance of sky flowers, after all, to be the solid stuff of their selves and the world they live in. That's a very long translation of this word, dharmas, self and dharmas, right? So self and everything else, right? The world one lives in. So we mistake the world, right? to be real in a way that it isn't. Again, it doesn't mean that it's not real in some way. It is, according to this. But it's just not real in the way we think it's real, or the way that we normally take it to be real, right? So we take this illusion, these sky flowers, to be the solid stuff of ourselves and our world, right? Doing this is what is called second nature. Imagining that which is mistaken, right? Or a more technical translation is something like schematizing that which is grasped, right? Or that which is taken. So, you know, we mistake the nature of the world as these sky flowers, and we say, ooh, nice sky flower, right? Here's a flower. This flower exists. And then we're just off to the races, right? In this, from that, you know, we imagine an entire world. This is the second nature, parikalpita, right? Which means sometimes translated as mere imagining, right? Or, you know, literally in the Chinese, it's schematizing or calculating, you know, that which is grasped or that which is mistaken in my translation. The things that we take to make up self and world in this way are all fundamentally empty, Heart Sutra language, in the sense that they just arise based on other things, right? You know, when the Big Bang happened, or however the universe began, this lectern was not there, right? So it does not exist free, you know, outside of the world of causation, right? It came here through this web of causation, and it will go away through a web of causation, right? There is no lectern here in the sense that we take it, or we sort of, Buddhists assume we take it, Buddhist doctrine assumes we take it, in this sometimes a little bit too simple-minded a way, as if it were, in fact, actually there, you know, in a way that we can rely on, in the sense that, boy, I'm just going to put all my marbles on this lectern, and this lectern will always be there for me, and I will never suffer because this lectern is always there for me. It's a stupid example, but, you know, I'm sorry I got caught up in this lectern business, which is there, right? But this is sort of the logic of these things. The reality that is made clear to us when we see this, that is, that things arise according to causes and conditions, is likened to empty space, right? The sky flowers aren't actually there. What is actually there? Space. It's the sky, right? Empty space. It, this, the thing that is the nature of things that is seen, and when one sees clearly in practice, is called, quote, perfectly complete reality. This is the third nature, right? In Yogacara, Buddhism. So what does all that mean? First of all, let me just restate or emphasize, right, that he says, Kuei-ji says, not just him, that if you can understand this, this is it, right? This is the base, this is really what Buddhist practice is about, according to him, right? According to this sort of Yogacara view. Preach on, pre-Zen, right, in many ways, although Zen is happening around this time. But a lot of these ideas very much fed into what became the Zen tradition, right? At the core, the practice is simple, and it's based on this mind-only insight, right? What does that mean? That this refers really to the second nature, right? Which was what? Ignorant beings, misunderstanding the nature of things, take what doesn't exist, what really exists, at least in the way they think it does, to be there, to be real, right? So you imagine that things are real based on this misunderstanding of what is actually happening in reality, right? That's called mere imagining, right? Or that is what is the essence of mind, the problem of mind, right, in this sense. Now, in Buddhism and Buddhist psychology, there are a lot of things that they talk about the mind to a great, you know, at great length, and they'll talk about it in many different ways, so I don't mean all of that. What I mean here is just this idea, right? That we take the world a certain way. The world as it actually is, according to these guys, is something that we can liken to empty space, right? Just blue sky, as opposed to blue sky full of clouds or blue sky full of airplanes, as is the case when I look outside my window. Right? Those things come and go. Those things aren't real, aren't the basic nature of reality, according to this verse. What is blue sky? Right. But remember that blue sky is just another metaphor, of course, and that's going to fall apart too, which is one of the reasons why, you know, you find again and again this really raft or bookshelf or something full of other ideas, metaphors, like, for example, empty, like, for example, inconceivable, right? Like, for example, ungraspable, right? These are all the, these are two, three or four of the things, are the ways, are the terms that are used to describe the way things actually are, right? Which is to say that you can't actually describe the way things actually are, right? The way things actually are in this view is inconceivable. It's ungraspable, right? Because any grasping, any taking of the world is just going to be some taking of the world, right? That's not actually the way things are. And what are those takings, right? What are those takings as? That's mind, right? That's why the world is mind only. Not that is, and what world do they mean here? They mean the world as we experience it, right? The world as we experience it is mind only, right? Is only consciousness. Now he's, the next thing, the next move he makes is to say, is to make very clear, or to try to make very clear, that what he doesn't mean by that is what, and this is how this is often understood, is to take, is to misunderstand this as meaning that there's something, what all this is actually mind, right? Some kind of godlike mind, some level, deepest level of reality that's just mind, right? That arises sometimes as a cup of water and sometimes as a guide yammering on and sometimes as a Buddha on an altar, right? That there's mind, right? There's this one mind. Now this is what other Buddhists will say is true, but this is not what Kuei-ji is saying, right? We can talk about those other guys. And in fact, the last time I gave a talk in here, I talked about those other guys. But here, Kuei-ji says, no, that is not what I mean. I don't mean that there's some level of mind that just, you know, appears in certain forms and goes into other forms, right? There's a famous set of images from that based on a text called The Awakening of Faith, where they talk about the world is like an ocean, mind is like ocean, and wind comes. What's the wind? Don't ask. But something like wind comes, and then you have certain waves that appear. And the waves are like, again, a cup of water, a book, guy yammering on, right? Piece of paper. And that those things go away into something else. And those forms, which don't last, they are, you know, not to be grasped onto. What is to be taken as real? The water, right? What is the water? Mind, the one mind. That is not what Kuei-ji means. Kuei-ji means, I think, or at least I want to argue here, something much simpler and much sort of easier to work with, right? And nothing so sort of metaphysical or mystic, you know, as water, you know, as the mind, right? Although I like that stuff. So I can give that talk too. But here, what he means is that, I think, is that the world that as we experience it is just mind, right? It's just our taking of it. And what is mind? Mind is our own personal minds, right? Our own personal histories, our own, you know, weirdnesses of how we take things. But also culture, I think it's fair to say. Also history, right? Also society. All those things, right, are just mind. So what do you mean culture, right? Well, say, you know, take the usual example of the Martian anthropologist or the Martian, you know, after the Martian invasion happens, right, and we've all been wiped out, and they're looking around I'm sorry, this is a terrible story now, the Earth, and they find this thing, right, and they say, what is this? You know, we don't know what this is. I think it must have been a weapon, right? Or it must have been something you sit on because their bodies were such that you actually wouldn't be comfortable to sit on this thing, right? or whatever. They take this in different ways, right? We immediately look at it and we see a lectern, right? Why? Does that mean because, you know, built into this thing somehow, as it appeared in the Big Bang, you know, or however the universe was created, was that it was a lectern? And because built into the Big Bang, right, was the whole cultural complex of lecturing, right? And audiences? No, right? All that stuff is, on the one hand, causes and conditions, right? First nature. And on the other hand, taking things as, right? We see this, and we don't just see it as a, you know, a couple of few pieces of wood. We see it as a lectern. Just boom, right? It's a lectern. Why? That's taking things out. That's mind, right? That's mind only. That's just mind. And again, mind is culture, mind is history, mind is our personal psychology, right? I think it's fair to say, I think it's important to say. So, for example, not fully what's going on in this famous story, but I think many of you will know the story where there's a flag, in the wind, whipping in the wind, and one monk is saying, "That is definitely the flag that's moving." And the other guy, monk, says, "Dude," right? Which is actually from classical Chinese. "Dude," he says, "it's the wind that's moving. Hello," right? "It's the wind. Flag, wind, flag, wind, flag, wind," right? And then, the teacher comes along, and I'm forgetting which one it was, and he says, "No, mind, right? It's the mind that's moving." Now that, whatever that might mean in its sort of ultimate sense, one thing it means is that what you guys are arguing about is what's moving is mind, right? You're taking it as wind. You're taking it as flag, right? I don't want to say that this exhausts that story. I don't think it does by any means. But for the kind of story I'm trying to spin here, that's one thing that it's about, right? Mind only, right? Because in the world as we experience it, things appear to us certain ways, right? And they don't just appear to us as a lectern. I did have a moment of dread when I saw the lectern. So there's some moment of dread coming immediately with the lectern. Why is that? Well, that's, because of some stuff in me, right? Stuff in the way I take the world and experiences, right? And I do think that the second nature, which is the crux of the problem for Kuai Ji and for the Yogacara tradition, invites, a kind of contemplative practice that is about investigating why we take things the way we do, right? Not just as lectern. That's pretty, you don't want to get rid of that so much, but the dread, right? Why do I see this thing? It's immediately, this is not just wood, this is dread, right? Oh, here I am, I'm a shy person, right? That is also mind only, right? This is the play of mind only, right, in the world, which again doesn't mean, he's not talking anyway, I think, about some mystic level of reality that's mind. Because maybe I'm just realizing that I'm just no mystic, right? I can't understand that deep stuff. But this kind of bit, that I could work with, right? That does seem right to me, right? The way I, somebody sits next to me on the Brown Line and immediately it's just, right? This guy is, that experience, that's mind only, right? The play of mind, which is the problem, right? Mind forged manacles. Mind and a mind-made world, right? How much time do I have? I'm yammering, huh? I'm happy I can stop.
If you want to have some discussion.
So that's, so you have a snake. You could really draw a lot of legs on a snake. That's basically, I had another page, but, it's all the same. So for Kuai Ji, this is the crux, these three steps, and all really focusing on seeing this process clearly, right? That the play of mind only, and then, acting accordingly, right? Cultivating the good, not cultivating the bad, whatever that means. I'll ask you what that means, and then from that, good stuff happens. So anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Paul. So, we have some time for comments, questions, responses, and some discussion, so please feel free.
The other side is a poem from the Huayanjing. They have an Avatamsaka Sutra that he quotes. Read it at your pleasure. Yeah.
Is the mind-only perspective sort of similar to the postmodernist perspective? That it's altered.
Tell me, what is the postmodernist perspective? That's an unfair question. That's a nasty question. But which one do you mean?
The idea that language and culture and upbringing dictate all of our kind of...
That there's no there. There's only the sort of this endless slippity slide of meaning and language and all that. Partly, except that... you tell me if I'm wrong about postmodernism here, or at least this, my simple-minded Derridian view of it, right, is or the Derridian view, is that, there's only that, right? there is no other, there is no blue sky, right? There is no suchness, right?
Right.
But for, this is something I was going to get to in the second page, but I was drawing, I was having too much fun drawing army boots on my snakes, my legs. But, you know, once you see that the world as you take it, and this is my understanding of Quakey here, is just mind only, right? You don't just say, oh, fine, whatever, right? You know, no, you actually want to see through it, and then we have this whole other world and whole other teachings of suchness, right? Or of the body of the Buddha. Because the world, this blue sky, right, is not just some empty nothing, that this is the body of the Buddha, right, in many teachings. This is what's called suchness, right? This is what's real, right, according to, for these guys. So in that sense, I would say, no, it's not. So yes, it is, but no, it's not, because there is a, what is it? There's a sort of a therapeutic or salvific, salvational, salvific
argument,
soteriological, impetus behind the whole thing, right? And that is, well, to practice Zazen, I suppose, right? To somehow not erase and, you know, just say, oh, you know, and not ride the brown line or something, because after all, I got to come here and give a talk, right? But actually, you know, to have a different kind of relationship then with the mind-only world of normal experience, right? Mm-hmm. Not to just say, well, this is just a bunch of crap.
So it's finding a deeper level to, like, relate to this mind level in a more, like, spacious way or something.
Something like that, yeah.
Right.
Or what do you think?
That's my idea. That
sounds good.
Basically, yeah.
I like it.
Question. You talk about the lectern and you could knock it and stop it.
Yeah.
But what about,
confirmed.
What about emotional concept, let's say compassion or something like that? How is that as far as the creation of mind?
So compassion, like, that's a good thing, you know, according to, you know, according to Buddhism, according to, in my experience. So the question is, is that also just mind only? And is that... Yeah, I think so. And is that also not just a, you know, a something that arises according to causes and conditions? I think yes and no, right? I mean, I think yes, for me, such as I experience it, which is rare. Oh, no, it's gone. But I think that in Buddhism, in Buddhist teachings, that... For example, there is a famous saying, right, that it comes from Nagarjuna, I believe, or at least attributed to him. The thought of emptiness, you know, seeing this stuff, right, gives rise to compassion. Or that, you know, the bird of Buddhist practice has two wings, though, so it can fly. One wing is insight, this stuff, and the other wing is compassion. Right? So I will... dodge this question mainly, but I think, say, no, I think, you know, yes and no. And the no side is something like built into, seems the wrong word, but there with suchness is something like compassion. I think that's what the Buddha's teachings say.
I think for me personally, something like compassion is not just a mind, it's a feeling, it's an actual...
Right.
I don't know how to describe it. You know, it's indescribable, ungraspable.
Yeah.
But you know, it's just it's something you feel inside. It just exists, and it's not.
Sounds good.
So I was thinking it's easy with physical things like a statue or a tree or something. But what about concepts?
Yeah. Well, then in fact, you know, I often get caught up in giving some. Like using an example that ends up being sort of trivial, right, and not as helpful, because, you know, after all, the lectern doesn't really cause me all that much suffering or trip me up that much. Whereas, you know, my the affective and intellectual afflictions, as they're called, I just said a bunch of trouble or something in my translation. They do, right, and that's really where the problems are, or how we went this time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul, since you said the poem on the other side, which we don't have time to go into in depth, but you said it's from the Huayan Jing, which...
Yeah, he quotes it.
Can you just say a tiny bit about this?
Sure. The mind, let me just read a little bit of it, right? The mind, like a skillful painter, variously paints the five skandhas. Not just the five skandhas, right? But paints the world as we experience it. In all the worlds, there is nothing that is not mind-created. Again, I think it's this same thing, right? I put mind in brackets because I think they translated it somewhat differently. Now, the next line, it gets a little bit deeper, right? I think it takes it into a deeper world here. As is the mind, so is the Buddha. Whoa. As is the Buddha, so are sentient beings. The mind, the Buddha, and sentient beings, all three are without distinction. All Buddhas understand that everything evolves from the mind. One who can understand likewise is one who can see the real Buddha. They translated that as the truth of the Buddha. I think it says the actual Buddha. The last four lines, and I'm not giving a very deep analysis of this, but the last four lines you see, not everywhere, but I have seen many times written as graffiti in Asia, in Chinese, in parts of Asia they speak Chinese. If one wishes to understand all Buddhas of the three times, one should understand and see that the mind creates all Tathagatas. Here we do seem to be a little bit deeper than just, you know, seeing. We're not just talking about the world as, I think, the world as experience that is sort of mind-created and mind-stained, you know, to use another Buddhist image here. But something else, right? So what does it mean, anyway? What does this mean? One should understand and see that the mind creates all Tathagatas, and this is what you really need to do. The three times, past, present, and future, by the way. He uses it simply as an illustration of what he had just been talking about, it's after this where he says, well, I don't mean that mind is some, you know, deeper sort of cosmic or metaphysical or something, spiritual level of the cosmos. Although you do get this in some forms of Yogacara Buddhism in the storehouse consciousness, right, which is how they explain karma, right, or the karmic seeds are lodged and where they, you know, they grow into the next thing.
So the last line, does that imply that we should create Buddhas? Create awakening.
Well, that's what the mind does. I'm reminded of another saying, a little story where something, and this is a poor remembering, but it's, the mind is likened to a blank sheet of paper, and you have your brush and your ink, and if you draw a Buddha, then there is a Buddha, right? If you draw a demon, then there is a demon. Right? So, as I understand that, then yes, we should create Buddhas, right? Don't want to create demons. Maybe that's in part what is meant by cultivate the good and cut off and the bad, right, or the evil. So yeah, so that would be one way of understanding it, as I understand this, certainly.
This sounds similar to tie into Dogen's, one should understand the condition, or study the conditions by which Buddha nature produces Buddha nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the condition. This is the process. You're talking about the process of how things happen.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
Or how things should happen under doing practice the right way.
Yeah.
So it seems like based on the second stanza with the mind, Buddha, this is the answer to Buddha. It's the first stanza. All Buddhas understand that everything evolves from the mind. One who can understand likewise is one who can see the real Buddha. Sort of then seems to work with the final one, that once you understand that, you understand that the mind creates all Tathagatas, that's when you see the real Buddha. So it's sort of like, what is the real Buddha apart from the Tathagatas created by the mind?
What's your answer?
I think the answer is that it is the world of experience, but without some of the projections we have, that making the split to something back to you, which I found where you'd seen through manas and through the
meaning
to the different things you know. No longer may perceive them as things, but you see and see through them. No longer caught in grasping those things. And perhaps the role of the mind then is different. It's still the mind, but it's an awakened mind, because it's no longer projecting and creating that split between me and the world and not among things. That's what I would guess.
Yes, Rachel.
I guess I had two questions. One is, how many, I know there's no way to really have a definitive number, but generally speaking, how many different ways of understanding happiness are there? And how has your scholarly study of that, if it's not too personal, enhanced your practice?
No, it's not too personal. But the first one, how many different ways of understanding emptiness are there? That is a very good question. I mean, on the one hand, you could give a kind of a correct, but maybe too flip answer and just say, you know, infinite. But maybe more helpful, at least from a scholarly point of view or historian of Buddhism point of view. You know, originally you have this idea of emptiness as meaning that there are these things called dharmas, right, that exist. They're sort of like atoms or building blocks, and they sort of scatter and recombine, you know, into different forms. And those forms are empty, but atoms, but the dharmas are not, right? Then you have the sort of rise of the Mahayana. This is a textbook, you know, picture of Buddhist thought, right? And which say Nagarjuna and these other, or the Prajnaparamita guys at first say, no, dharmas are empty too. Dharmas are also a cause. Dharmas are all. And then, you know, you're sort of off to the races in a sense of everything being empty in the sense that, I mean, empty is such a difficult term because it's hard not to hear empty in English in 21st century and not think it's a negative thing, right? When, of course, emptiness is the greatest of all things, right? You know, one of them, at least in Buddhism. I mean, I always love this story that I think Thich Nhat Hanh tells, and maybe in his commentary, the brief commentary of the Heart Sutra, where he has, you know, don't know if he made up the story or not, but it's a nice story. You know, a child goes to, I can't remember if it's a girl or a boy, you know, let's just say her father is upset about emptiness and all things, impermanence and all things changing. And she's saying, Dad, you know, I could never grow up, you know, if it wasn't for emptiness. You know, and so emptiness is good, right? But it's very hard to hear that. And so when in teaching class, in college, I try to avoid the word, because some people will just say, oh, Buddhism doesn't like the world. Buddhism says things are empty. And then you just spend the rest of some quarter, you know, just trying to convince them that that's wrong. And it's like, no. So it's a difficult term. But we would just have to go on too long to give all the different ways. But I would say many ways, right? And you also have, with this sort of wave and water image, you know, you have the idea that, you know, what is that the phenomenal world that is understood as empty is actually itself, right? The body of the Buddha, right? So you have the famous Dogen quoting Sudongpo Sutra, you know, the wind, I forget how it goes, the wind, the sound of the valleys, you know, that is the Buddha's broad tongue, right? This is a very different view of emptiness, even though it's sort of following the logic of emptiness to where it, you know, sort of needs to go, I think. The other question, the personal question, I mean, this is my question, right? You know, how does academic study, book learning, historical study, you know, how does that help me in my practice? I mean, I was a practitioner first, right, before I was a scholar. And I've certainly gone, you know, emphasized both sides of that, you know, to the, in some, you know, for year spans, you know, to the, you know, forgetting about the other, you know, for fair number of years now, I've tried to keep them both together. But how? I don't know. I mean, I think it helps me to, you know, conceptual understanding, even though concepts are maybe, you know, not going to get you there, concept thinking helps, right? I mean, and one of the things I like about Kweji, and I didn't read it, but he opens the text, really, by saying practice is also about thinking, you know, and about reading, right? And about reading correctly, right? And my scholarly study, you know, learning languages and trying to be a disciplined philological scholar, I feel like helps me a lot in trying to, in reading the text, right? It also makes me a pain in the ass, you know? But, and maybe sometimes it's helpful and sometimes it's not. Thank you.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for opening this up to us and giving a kind of practical view of what mind only is. It's this less esoteric and metaphysical, but I think very practical. So I think it's very helpful. Well, at least I feel so.
Well, thank you. I've been fine.